Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
New York Yankees fans who appreciate that over many years, George Steinbrenner spent a great deal of money to make their team competitive, consider him a fine fellow. Unless they're the fans who regard Steinbrenner as an idiot for interfering in the day-to-day operation of the ball club and overruling his employees to buy the wrong players. In his new book, George, the Poor Little Rich Boy Who Built the Yankee Empire, Peter Golenbach has tried to present the complete story of the man who ran the Yankees for parts of four decades, at least when he hadn't been suspended for various malfeasances. When I spoke with Peter Golenbach recently, I asked him to review the circumstances of the Yankees team George Steinbrenner bought in 1973.
CBS owned the Yankees from 1965 to the winter of 1973 when Bill Paley, the owner of CBS, decided he didn't want the team anymore. Michael Burke, who was like an adopted son to Paley, was given the opportunity to buy it for $10 million. Paley had paid $14 million for it, and he thought that $10 million was a fair price considering that the Yankees hadn't done all that well. So Mike Burke decided that he needed people to invest with him. And the very first person to contact Burke about buying the Yankees was this Cleveland shipbuilder by the name of George Steinbrenner. And Steinbrenner had a lot of wealthy friends as well. And sight unseen, without doing any research at all, Michael Burke agreed to take George Steinbrenner on as a co-owner of the Yankees.
When he bought into the Yankees, George Steinbrenner announced quite publicly that his expertise was in shipbuilding and that he wouldn't have much to do with running the baseball team. Do you think that that was really ever his intention?
You know, having researched his entire life, he never took a back seat to anybody in almost anything that he ever did. So I truly can't understand why it was he said that. Also, I was with the Yankees in the winter of 1973. I was researching my very first book, Dynasty. So I was there when Steinbrenner and Michael Burke took over. And about 3 weeks later, a friend of mine came over to me and said, "You got to hear this." And he and I, we walked over to the elevator shaft and put our ears to it. And about three floors up, we could hear two men, and one of them was screaming the most vile epithets at the other one at the top of his lungs so that you could hear it three flights down. And of course, the person doing the screaming was George Steinbrenner, and the person he was screaming at was Michael Burke. So we sort of looked at each other and we said, you know, this partnership is not going to last very long. And of course, it didn't. I interviewed Burke and I asked him, and I said, you know, why did you leave? And he said something about 2 feet fitting uncomfortably in one small shoe.
Besides pouring a great deal of money into the team, what else did George Steinbrenner do to help create a winner?
There were actually two periods of Yankee success. And the first period was the Bronx Zoo period, 1976 to 1978. And the other period was the Joe Torre period beginning in 1996. And the interesting thing that I discovered was that prior to each of those periods, George Steinbrenner had been suspended from baseball for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what does that mean? Well, Steinbrenner hated rookies. He didn't trust them. He didn't want them. He basically wanted stars, or failing that, he wanted veterans. And so he would always trade away the most promising prospects. He could not do that prior to the Bronx Zoo years because he was suspended. He had wanted to trade Ron Guidry, tried to do it twice. Gabe Paul stopped him. And as a result of Guidry and a couple other rookies, the Yankees were able to win. Flash forward to the 90s. In 1990, with George running the team all by himself, the Yankees had the very first draft pick. And the reason they got the first pick was that they were the very worst team in baseball. Now, not long after that, George Steinbrenner got involved in the Howie Spira mess. He had paid $40,000 to a disreputable fellow, for information about one of his players, Dave Winfield. And the commissioner suspended him from baseball for the 2 years. And during those 2 years, he was unable to trade Bernie Williams, Andy Pettit, Mariano Rivera, Jorge Posada, and a kid shortstop by the name of Derek Jeter. Prior to his suspension, he had wanted or talked about trading at least two or three of them.
Lots of baseball fans will remember that Steinbrenner hired and fired Billy Martin as his manager multiple times. Few of them may be aware of how damaged Martin was during his last couple of shifts with the Yankees.
Well, I think he was damaged throughout. He was Yankee manager five times, and every time he managed, the team was spectacular. He was a great manager. What Billy had no ability to do was to handle George Steinbrenner. He was just totally inept when it came to figuring George out. George Steinbrenner was convinced that he was smarter when it came to managing than Billy was. And so every day he would send him notes. Billy, so-and-so should take batting practice. You should move so-and-so from the second spot to the eighth spot. And I know this because he showed me the notes. Billy showed me the notes. I mean, it's hysterical if it didn't make Billy so crazy. And he did this with every single one of his managers. It didn't matter who the manager was, and that included Joe Torre, of course. The difference was Torre knew how to handle George Steinbrenner.
I was surprised, all of this information notwithstanding, though, to learn that at least during his last two shifts with the Yankees, Martin was drinking during the afternoon, showing up drunk at night games, and sometimes leaving games to go to bars between innings, that sort of thing. How did you find out about that sort of thing?
He didn't hide it very much. I mean, Billy's alcoholism became worse and worse with each of his, you know, periods with the Yankees. And every time Billy would say to me, this time George has changed. This time he's going to be different. This time we're going to be friends. Well, you know, George and Billy were never friends. It was always the same relationship, and it didn't matter the first time, the third time, the fifth time. The criticisms never abated. The pressure never abated. And as Billy got older and the alcoholism took more of a toll, it was just harder and harder for Billy to cope.
Perhaps the low point of George Steinbrenner's tenure as owner of the Yankees came when he heard a stadium full of fans chanting, Steinbrenner sucks. What were the circumstances leading to that occasion?
George always wanted to be the guy the fans loved the most. He wanted to be known as the man responsible for the success of the Yankees. And that's not easy to do when you've got people like Billy Martin, when you've got people like Reggie Jackson or Dave Winfield or, you know, whatever stars he had. So they reached a point where Reggie Jackson's contract ran out. And Reggie clearly was the most popular member of the Yankees and not George. And I do believe that that was one of the reasons he decided that Reggie was over the hill, that he couldn't be productive anymore. And so he let him go and he went to the California Angels. The next year, in April, he came back, Reggie came back, and hit a home run. I believe it was the first game of that season. And that's when, as he was circling the bases, the Yankee fans started to chant, Steinbrenner sucks, Steinbrenner sucks. And they were chanting it for quite a long while. And the funny thing is that after the game, he came into the clubhouse absolutely furious, only to find the ball players chuckling at him, which made him even more furious.
In the 1990s, George Steinbrenner became a figure of fun, as unlikely as that may seem, when a character representing him was written into the TV show Seinfeld. At one point, one of the program's main characters, George Costanza, is trying to get fired from his position with the Yankees so that he can get a better job with the Mets. And Costanza pulls Babe Ruth's jersey from a trophy case. He puts it on, and he spills strawberry juice all over it. And then boss Steinbrenner calls him in for a meeting. Let's listen to that.
Wanted to see me, sir?
I heard about what happened at the meeting this morning.
Yes, I already packed up my desk, sir, so I can be out of here in an hour.
And I have to tell you, it's exactly what this organization needed. If we want to look to the future, we've got to tear down the past. Babe Ruth was nothing more than a fat old man with little girl legs. And here's something I just found out recently. he wasn't really a sultan. Huh? What do you make of that?
I mean, this is a guy who would fire anybody at the drop of the hat. And whatever Costanza would do, the poor guy could not get himself fired. It was genius. It was hysterically funny. And I also believe that because this Steinbrenner character was on Seinfeld for the 4 years, that fans took a much kinder view of him because they said to themselves, anybody who could allow himself to be lampooned like that must be a pretty good guy.
You go into some detail toward the end of the book of all of the good that George Steinbrenner has done. Tell us a little bit about that.
I'd be happy to. One of the things I discovered was just how many high school kids he has helped funding scholarships, especially among high school athletes. George is so revered in Tampa that they are naming a high school after him, the George M. Steinbrenner High School. Every year he has this fabulous banquet for high school coaches and high school athletes. He started an organization for the sons and daughters of firemen and policemen who were injured on the job to make sure that their kids can get scholarships to college, and he's done that in Tampa and in New York. You talk to people in Tampa about the good deeds, how many colleges he has given money to for facilities, for sporting facilities, Eckerd College, University of Florida, all sorts of places. I was at MIT recently, and there was George M. Steinbrenner Field. His father had gone to MIT. George has done a lot of good for a lot of people.
Age and disease have robbed George Steinbrenner of his energy and taken him away from the daily business of running the Yankees. Do you have any sense of how he's doing these days?
From what I understand, he has both dementia and Alzheimer's, and it's very serious and very sad. I went to the last game at the old Yankee Stadium last year, and it was a marvelous, marvelous ceremony, and he wasn't there. And I thought that was very sad. I mean, here's this guy, he came from Cleveland, but in no time he became, you know, the biggest thing in sports in New York. He was the Yankees, and for him not to be at that closing ceremony, I just thought was very, very sad.
Do you feel that the Yankees are in better shape in the hands of George Steinbrenner's sons than they were when the boss at his full capacity was in charge?
I do. The two boys are really terrific people, and they do not have narcissism. They do not believe they're the smartest people on the planet. They're people who respect their employees, and they'll let their general manager do the job, let their manager do the job. And I can tell you this because early in the season, in one of the very early games, Cleveland came to the new Yankee Stadium and beat the Yankees 22-4. And I am convinced that if George Steinbrenner had been there, that Joe Girardi would have been fired right after that game.
Peter Golenbach is the author of George, the Poor Little Rich Boy Who Built the Yankee Empire, published by Wiley. He joined me from the studios of WUSF in Tampa. Peter, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Always a pleasure, Bill. Always.
My conversation with Peter Golenbach, the author of George, the Poor Little Rich Boy Who Built the Yankee Empire, will be featured on this week's program. I'll also be talking with Helene Elliott, our soothsayer of the speediest sport on slick surfaces, about the NHL finals, which begin this weekend. We'll have a story about how fans in Cleveland have handled what's happened to the Cavaliers in the NBA's Eastern Conference Finals, and we'll explore what's happened to the Toronto Blue Jays, who've been tumbling from the lofty perch they unexpectedly assumed earlier this spring. And then, turning away from the major sports, we'll visit the wonderful world of college lumberjacking, courtesy of Only a Game's Karen Given. So join us, and remember, you can always listen to the program at onlyagame.org.